Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. The musical Hamilton is a groundbreaking piece of musical theater that at the same time is inspiring and entertaining. The use of rap allows for a great deal of exposition and historical background to be shared with an audience in a short period of time. But how historically accurate is that information? Historians differ, but my guest today says overall, Lin-Manuel Miranda's creation is more faithful to history than not. Dr. Richard Bell is a historian specializing in early American history and an associate professor of history at the University of Maryland. He's the author of several books, including a forthcoming book due out next month on the Reverse Underground Railroad, criminal groups in the early part of the 19th century that would kidnap free blacks and take them south into slavery. But this Sunday at Gilcrease Museum, he'll be talking about the historical accuracy of the Pulitzer Prize-winning musical in a talk titled Hamilton, How the Musical Remixes American History. The talk takes place Sunday afternoon at 2 o'clock at Gilcrease and is free with museum admission. Professor Richard Bell is my guest today. Richard Bell, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thanks for the invitation, Rich.
As you preview your talk Sunday at Gilcrease, historians are divided about the musical Hamilton as history. Some say what liberties the musical takes with the actual history are fairly small compared with its generally accurate way it portrays the overall historic record and the nature of conflicts between the founding fathers, which I think is one of the things a lot of people think it does well. Others take issue with the nature of who Hamilton was in the musical, a reinvention of sort. What's your take?
Yeah, I think that's a smart assessment of where the debate stands right now, Rich. And there are certainly some tough takes out there on this musical, some of them coming from historians, other coming from people in the black community, and there's some overlap, of course, between those two communities. The tough takes I can return to in a minute, but what I would say right off the bat is that this musical is a wonderful opportunity for people who do what I do for a living, which is teach about American history, to embrace this, you know, roller coaster, blockbuster phenomenon, which has got a lot of people, a lot of young people, even a lot of people of color as well, very interested and engaged in thinking about the American past and the American Revolution and the Founding Fathers in particular. So I want to have that debate with as many people as possible about what this musical gets right, what it gets wrong, and, you know, why it all matters, whether it does or doesn't. You know, this is a Broadway musical, after all, and no one goes to another Broadway musical like SpongeBob SquarePants the Musical expecting, you know, SpongeBob and Squidward and the gang to get marine biology just spot on. So nevertheless, Lin-Manuel Miranda, the absurdly talented composer, librettist behind this show, went to extraordinary lengths to try to get this musical close, to try to get it right. He did a lot of historical research in the real Alexander Hamilton's surviving papers. He consulted with historian experts, and he read lots of history books about the subject. So I know he tried to hold himself to a very high standard.
I think it's probably far more accurate than the only other musical I can think about the Founding Fathers, which would be 1776.
Yeah, there's a reason there aren't too many musicals about the Founding Fathers out there, I think.
In your view, what does the musical get most right about the actual history?
So I think it gets a lot right, first of all. And the most important things beyond the general contours of Alexander Hamilton's life, and most notably the circumstances of his death when he was shot by the Vice President of the United States at the time, Aaron Burr, in a duel in New Jersey in 1804, which brought his life and therefore obviously his career to an end, the larger things it gets right have to do with the bitter partisan fighting between the people we know and revere as the Founding Fathers during the 1790s and the early 1800s. There are scenes in the second half of the play where characters based on real historical figures like Thomas Jefferson, Aaron Burr, Alexander Hamilton, James Madison, a couple of others, the audience really gets to see just how much some of those people detested each other, just how much infighting, one-upmanship, partisanship, polarization there was amongst these people who we sometimes assume were a merry band of brothers, when really they were not.
It's almost a Shakespearean story in a way, where you have this huge father figure, George Washington. When he steps down, all of a sudden, all of this, if there ever was a band of brothers, it evaporates.
That's right. I mean, George Washington looms over this musical in important ways. In the same way, he loomed over the early republic and early attempts at sorting out what on earth a republican form of government would look like. And yeah, it's relatively straightforward to be unified during wartime when you have a common enemy. In this case, the Patriots fighting against the British. And some of your listeners may detect the British accent that I bring to this talk about what this musical gets right and gets wrong, which is sort of interesting. But once peace has been declared, once the Treaty of Paris has been signed and the ink is dry and the British have largely gone home, that's when divisions and fissures and tensions and egos start to clash amongst the people who were all on the same team during the revolution. Now they find themselves dividing into different teams. The first party system, we call it, where we see Federalists like Alexander Hamilton, like John Adams, and to some extent George Washington, pitted against people they now regard as their political enemies, the Democratic Republicans, led by Thomas Jefferson and James Madison, both of Virginia.
And what's interesting when you actually look at the real history is even though, yes, they do divide into parties, there are even factions within the parties because Hamilton and John Adams had no love lost between the two of them.
That's right. And that actually is brought to life on stage. And it's interesting how Miranda and his team do that because you never see John Adams. And yet John Adams, who becomes the second president of the United States after Washington steps down, looms very large over the second half of the show, sort of as a bogeyman, offstage bogeyman. You hear his loud, deep voice coming over the sound system, but you never see him. So he's sort of an offstage enemy. But the tension between him and Alexander Hamilton is palpable in the brief exchanges that Alexander Hamilton has with this offstage disembodied voice. And some of the meanest lines of the entire show are said either by John Adams about Hamilton or by Hamilton about John Adams, both members of the same party, this Federalist Party, which emerged in the shadow of the Washington administration.
Was it strictly a rivalry over who was going to lead that new party?
I think there was some of that. Certainly the show leans into that idea that Alexander Hamilton had his eyes set on the presidency, and a series of events and scandals prevented him from ever acceding to that role. But it also had to do, political and personal tensions about what the right choices were. These folks, whether they be Federalists, whether they be Democratic Republicans, didn't have a roadmap. They didn't know what the future held. To put that more bluntly, Rich, when it comes to policy and politics in the new republic, they were making it up as they went along.
And both of those gentlemen were, I guess to put it in the vernacular, the smartest guy in the room.
Well, there's no shortage of intellect, I think, in the cabinet of George Washington and in the administration of John Adams and Thomas Jefferson. But what I like about the show, again, one of the many things this show gets right, is to show these people not as marble pedestal figures like, a Greek philosopher or Aristotle or what have you, but as flesh and blood men driven as much by ego and emotion and animosity as they are by intellect and enlightened principle.
So if that's one of the key things that the musical gets right, what does the musical get wrong in your view?
So there's a couple of ways to answer that. The small way is to say there are a few tiny things here and there it gets wrong. Folks who come to hear my presentation on Sunday, the Gilcrease, will get a handout where I list 15 different plot points that the musical is at odds with the surviving sources we have about what really happened. But many of those things are actually pretty small. You find that, Miranda conflates events from time to time. He conflates characters from time to time. A few things happen in the wrong order. The particular political clash that brought Aaron Burr and Alexander Hamilton to the Weehawken shore isn't explained accurately. But these are really relatively minor things in the big scheme of things. I'd even be so bold as to say that if folks who saw Hamilton the musical never learned anything else from any other types of sources than what they see on stage, they could do worse than use Hamilton the musical as their textbook. But the larger answer, and this is what I spend a lot of time in my presentation on Sunday planning to talk about, is some of the larger themes that I don't think this musical tackles perhaps with as much nuance or sophistication as someone as obviously smart as Miranda might be capable of. So there are issues to do with the presentation of women, 18th century women. There are issues to do with the presentation of immigrants and immigration. There are issues to do with the presentation of slavery and the fight against slavery. And there's some important stuff to do with the way the American Revolution is portrayed on stage as well.
Well, let's talk about slavery. Hamilton, by the standards of the Founding Fathers' era, was somewhat abolitionist. He was happy. I think he evolved somewhat, but he was probably far more liberal on that than certainly any of the Virginians and really most of the Founding Fathers, wouldn't you say?
I take some of what you said, Rich. Yeah. I think if you're looking to rank the Founding Fathers on their racial views and their relationship to slavery, then comparing Hamilton to someone like Thomas Jefferson makes Hamilton look pretty good. I mean, Thomas Jefferson, who wrote the Declaration of Independence with the famous line, "All men are created equal," in July 1776, Jefferson died fully 50 years later in 1826, owning more slaves on the day he died than the day he wrote that all men are created equal. So if you draw up Hamilton alongside someone like Jefferson, then yes, Hamilton looks like a pretty progressive figure. He was certainly, for a few brief years towards the end of his life, a member of a moderate anti-slavery society in New York City called the New York Manumission Society. Manumission is the idea that slave owners voluntarily and individually give slaves their freedom. But that was a pretty moderate anti-slavery society, as I said, far less radical than some other groups of people who were active at the time. And Hamilton's personal relationship to slavery is very complicated. We know that he grew up around slaves. There were slaves owned by close members of his family. When he married Eliza Schuyler, and that marriage is a central relationship in the musical, he married into one of the largest and wealthiest slave-owning families in what was then the New York colony, then New York State. There were slaves in that family while he was in it. Historians are confused by surviving sources, which seem to imply that Hamilton and Eliza may have owned a couple of slaves themselves at some point in their life. Hamilton certainly bought slaves for his sister-in-law, Angelica, at least one point. So to be a member of a moderately anti-slavery society is not nothing. But in the context of the tumult over the future of slavery in the early republic, it's not everything either. And I think the musical, for all its many, many, many strengths, sometimes gives Hamilton a bit of a pass. Yes. On that, referring to him as an abolitionist as opposed to something more moderate like an anti-slavery activist. Now, that said, there's a recent exhibition put up by the Hamilton production and creative team. It's right now it's in Chicago, but this exhibition about the musical and about the Founding Father will travel. And I got to see it in Chicago a couple of weeks ago, and I was really pleased by the attention that the historical consultants to the exhibition, the lengths they went to clarify Hamilton's confusing relationship to slavery, something that doesn't come across clearly in the 3 hours of all singing, all dancing, musical theater you see up on stage.
Of course, Hamilton was very much concerned with property rights, and property rights during the Revolutionary era and the first 100 years of the country meant slavery rights, too.
Yeah, I think that's right. I mean, there's a real tension in the early republic between property rights and human rights, to be quite frank, and people choose sides. And I think, as you say, Hamilton knew what his priorities were.
The other fair criticism of the musical is this idea of reinventing Hamilton as, you know, and emphasizing his immigrant story and common man story rising to the top. But it sounds to me, from what I've read from history, that Hamilton was a guy who might have climbed the ladder, but would want to pull the ladder out behind him. I know historian Sean Willett says, you know, Hamilton represented more of the 1% than the 99% in nearly all of his political writings.
I think that's pretty astute, actually, Rich. And I think I would ascribe to that exact same idea that on the one hand, Hamilton is an amazing, Alexander Hamilton's real life is an amazing up by his bootstraps story, born into poverty in the Caribbean. Migrates to the American colonies and becomes prosperous, successful, marries well, gains access to political power through his military career and subsequent work with George Washington as aide-de-camp during the war. and translates that into a political, an economic pedestal on which he sits for the rest of his life. He dies pretty wealthy, is my understanding. So what we do with that is interesting, or rather what Miranda has done with that is interesting. Miranda, I think, paints Hamilton as a model immigrant, as a hero to immigrants living today in the United States and around the world. There's some great lines in the show. One is, "Immigrants, we get the job done," that Alexander Hamilton and the Marquis de Lafayette sing to each other and then high five. And whenever I've seen the show, it gets a standing ovation and a round of applause from people in the audience, including me, because I'm an immigrant myself. We eat that up. It's good to see immigrants in positions of power and in the spotlight. But it's also true that Alexander Hamilton, as you said, Rich, pulled the ladder up behind him somewhat in terms of his political and policy choices when he was in power. So the most famous and arguably egregious example of that is something called the Alien and Sedition Acts, passed in 1798 in the midst of the John Adams administration. Hamilton is I think he's a major in the army at that point, but he wields considerable political power, and he is one of the creators of and most vocal supporters of this suite of new laws passed in the midst of a war against France to silence political dissent, to silence political opposition to the John Adams administration. And those laws target the rights as immigrants and future citizens of Irish dissenters and some French dissenters, too. These laws try to make it harder for Irish dissenters who disagree with the president to remain in the United States. They threaten them with deportation. They bar them from a path to naturalization and citizenship. I want to point out, by the way, that the Alien and Sedition Act have subsequently been considered wholly unconstitutional, but that didn't stop them from going into effect in 1798. And Hamilton was right there cheering on these pieces of legislation, actually chiding John Adams for not enforcing them more toughly. So if we're looking to the mature Alexander Hamilton as someone who wants to bring other immigrants with him on this journey from poverty to prosperity and political power, then it's hard to square the real Alexander Hamilton with the singing, dancing founding father we see on stage.
My guest today is Richard Bell. He's an associate professor at the University of Maryland in history, specializing in early United States history. And he'll be speaking Sunday at Gilcrease on Hamilton, How the Musical Remixes American History. And he's our guest today on Studio Tulsa. He's also the author of a forthcoming book titled Stolen. Well, we've talked a little bit about Hamilton. Aaron Burr, of course, the antagonist of the story, if you will. The circumstances over their enmity and duel. You mentioned, you know, there's a little quibbling things, conflating characters, which is pretty normal in any sort of film, musical, or whatever, because you just can't, introduce hundreds of characters. But the circumstances over their duel, I think the musical makes it like it's happening right after 1800 when Hamilton throws his support behind Jefferson to make Jefferson president. In fact, it happens 4 years later, and it's all the circumstances are about a gubernatorial race in New York.
Yeah, I don't have much to add to that very accurate description, Rich. That yes, in the show, the duel between Burr and Hamilton seems to come about, and again, the circumstances are slightly unclear on stage, but seems to come about as the culminating event of longstanding tension between the two men, which is catalyzed to a duel by Hamilton throwing his support to Jefferson in one of the rounds of voting in the election of 1800. And it's true that Hamilton did throw his support behind Jefferson, but it's also true that the duel between Hamilton and Burr didn't take place, as you noted, for another 4 years. And the immediate catalyzing events for the duel were some very disparaging remarks that Alexander Hamilton made about Aaron Burr's candidacy to be governor of New York in that election. Burr, of course, got wind of them because the remarks made it into the papers, demanded retraction. Hamilton refused, then demanded the satisfaction. And the two of them met at dawn on the Weehawken shore in New Jersey. And because Hamilton died in that duel, which, by the way, was a relatively rare thing in duels between men of honor in the late 18th and early 19th century, There were lots of duels fought, by the way. Hamilton, I think, was involved in more than 10 of them in his whole life, but fatalities were relatively rare. They were usually settled by some sort of negotiation before shots were fired. But the death of Hamilton in that duel not just brought to an end all too soon an extremely promising political career, but it consigned Aaron Burr arguably to the dustbin of history. We see that those consequences for Burr and those consequences for Hamilton, that he gets martyred effectively, that he gets lauded as someone gone too soon, a hero of sorts in the musical. And there's some extremely powerful lines in the show where Aaron Burr briefly reflects in the show's last number or two about the effect it's had on his political and personal future. He sings to the audience. He says, "Now I'm the villain in your history," which, you know, Aaron Burr was not a cartoon villain. And he's not portrayed as a cartoon villain in most of the show, to be clear. But the fact that he killed Alexander Hamilton, the first Secretary of the Treasury, a close friend of Washington, has, I think, consigned his reputation to something of the dustbin of history. And one of the things I like about this show is that for all but the last 10 minutes, Aaron Burr is someone the audience can readily identify with as a complicated, flawed, ambitious man, no less interesting, captivating on stage than Alexander Hamilton is. You could even say that Aaron Burr is the main character in Hamilton the musical for most of its running time.
If Hamilton theatergoers want a more nuanced view of the events and actors of this drama, what's the best place to go? Is there a couple of books that you would recommend?
There's probably a lot of different books I would recommend. Now, your audiences will know that the Hamilton musical is based explicitly on a biography of Alexander Hamilton written by the historian Ron Chernow. And I think most other historians regard that biography as a fair and decent account of Hamilton's life in most respects. There have been major quibbles with the way Chernow portrays Hamilton as a progressive and radical anti-slavery freedom fighter, which I've sort of mentioned in this conversation. But in many other respects, the Chernow biography is entirely worth a look, though it's an 800-page look at Alexander Hamilton. So I just point out a couple of other books. I mentioned dueling in an earlier answer, and there's a wonderful book about political contest, about political partisanship and political fighting, both figurative and literal, between congressmen and other politicians in the early republic. And that book is well worth a read. It's called Affairs of Honor, and it's by the Yale historian Joanne Freeman, who was actually one of the consultants for the exhibition that is now touring the country, filling in some of the gaps that the show itself couldn't manage to fill up on stage for 3 hours. So Affairs of Honor by Joanne Freeman is a good place to start. There's also another book by a colleague of mine called Founding Friendships, which is about exactly what it sounds like. It's about Founding Friendships by Cassandra Good, which is a good pairing with Affairs of Honor, which is all about the opposite of friendship, about animosity and rivalry and mortality and violence.
Richard Bell is my guest. He's an associate professor of history at the University of Maryland and will be speaking Sunday at Gilcrease on Hamilton, How the Musical Remixes American History. But he's also a scholar and researcher in his own right, and he has a forthcoming book coming out next month titled Stolen. And it is about something that I never even knew existed, and that's to my fault. And it's something called the Reverse Underground Railroad. What was the Reverse Underground Railroad?
Right, yes. So the Underground Railroad is probably quite familiar to most folks out there listening. This is folks like Harriet Tubman going to great personal risk to assist fugitives from slavery achieve their freedom. So the Reverse Underground Railroad is the phenomenon of people, most of them white, some of them black, who worked hard to turn free Americans into slaves. So we're thinking here, if you've seen the movie 12 Years a Slave or read the original memoir on which it's based, you know the story of Solomon Northup, a free black man living in New York State who is duped and kidnapped into slavery, sold into slavery in Louisiana, and stays there for 12 years unable to escape. He's a victim of the Reverse Underground Railroad. He's a passenger on that Reverse Underground Railroad, if you will. And I'm writing a book, I have written a book, which is coming out in October, about five small free black boys, aged between about 8 and about 16, who were all kidnapped together from the streets of Philadelphia in 1825 with the intention that their kidnappers will sell them into slavery in Alabama and Mississippi. And I follow their journey into the slave South in great detail. And I follow the miraculous and entirely unexpected series of events which lead these five boys to be able to return home. I'm not going to say much more about the series of events. I hope people will buy the book and learn more. But it's a very human story told at a small scale with the hope that it will illuminate this larger phenomenon of the thousands, if not tens of thousands, of free black people who were kidnapped into slavery between the Revolution and the Civil War.
Your story details one of those conspiracy chains, but there were a number of them, a lot in Maryland and Delaware, some further west in Illinois, and these folks were basically finding free blacks in the North, in the non-slave-holding North, and kidnapping them and moving them south and selling them.
Yeah, that's right, Rich. This is an American phenomenon, right? To give you a sense of the scale, obviously quantifying the exact number of people, children, adults, kidnapped into slavery within the United States between the Revolution and the Civil War is very difficult because this was a criminal enterprise conducted by dozens, hundreds, if not thousands of different operatives, often working individually or only in small groups. There's no grand conspiracy here. This is wholly opportunistic and localized, but it happens again and again and again. And it means that the freedom line, which we often think in our minds of dividing the free northern states from the unfree southern slave states by the 1810s, 20s, or 30s, was largely a fiction. You know, kidnappers and enslavers would come across the freedom line from home bases in places like Maryland, Virginia, and Delaware, snatch as many free black street kids as they could gather over a couple of days, toss them into the hold of a ship, and try to get them into the Deep South as quickly as possible to sell them at great profit to planters setting up there, setting up new cotton plantations there, planters who more often than not didn't ask too many questions about exactly where these people came from, or if they did ask questions, were willing to accept a knockdown purchase price if they were troubled by the answer. So this went on for decades. At the same time, that there was a wholly legal redistribution of slaves from the Upper South to the Lower South. And the reason why they targeted free black children is probably pretty obvious, right? The smaller you are, the weaker you are, the more vulnerable you are, the less likely to carry your free papers that you are, the easier it is to decoy you, spirit you away, and try to give you a new identity and a new life as someone else's property 1,000 miles away.
And that's the story of your book.
That's right.
All right. Well, we look forward to that. Richard Bell, thanks so much for your time today.
Thanks, Rich. I appreciate it.
Richard Bell is an associate professor of history at the University of Maryland, specializing in early U.S. history. He'll be speaking Sunday afternoon at 2 at Gilcrease Museum on Hamilton, How the Musical Remixes American History. The lecture is free with museum admission. Information at gilcrease.org. By the way, he's also the author of the forthcoming book, Stolen, Five Free Boys Kidnapped into Slavery and Their Astonishing Odyssey Home. That's due out in October from Simon & Schuster. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.